I was a precinct committeeman. I was associated with the Democratic Party and had worked against the great popular Ronald Reagan. And he got reelected despite my efforts. I was asked at that point to run for the city council. And John Lee Johnson was active then, and John Lee Johnson asked me to run for the council, showed me around, took me up to City Hall, showed me the minutes for meetings, and urged me to run. And it was soft-pedaled to me by those who were urging me to run. Oh, yeah, you just have a meeting once a week, you know. It's not much heavy lifting. And, of course, they successfully misrepresented the job to me, so I ran with enthusiasm.
You found out there was actual work involved.
Yes. And, of course, the city's grown. The issues and the dollar amounts have become more complex and higher. And the size of the city has grown enormously since the 80s.
That's one of the questions I had of looking at, you know, both Champaign and Urbana have grown over the years, but Champaign has grown more. What does that growth say about what sort of city Champaign is?
A fortunate city. Champaign has the confluence of two major highways. Early on, we got the railroad in the 1850s. That was helpful. Urbana got some things that were considered in the 19th century real plums, as did Danville. They got the courthouse. They're the county seat. And they have the federal courthouse. But many of the economic drivers in the Metroplex ended up in Champaign. You know, certainly the positioning of the highways has been vital because that's produced regional shopping that is a draw from all of East Central Illinois. And Urbana did not get that for whatever reason.
We're downtown right now, and one of the things I'm wondering that you touched on is the changes downtown has seen since you first went on the council in the 80s.
Well, they're comprehensive, but the one continuity downtown is our interest in historic preservation. Part of the reason the downtown has been a success in Champaign, and what goaded that success to begin with, was an effort to preserve vintage building stock. We opened up our access to A-class liquor licenses with a caveat, with a condition. We said, if you are prepared to move in to a building that is more than 50 years old and bring it up to code at your own expense, we'll consider letting you have an A license. And this turned out to be an incentive that drove much of the revitalization of our downtown, which helps explain, given the nature of the incentive, why our downtown is largely an adult entertainment place. We're trying to soften that and change it by considering a downtown plaza proximate to the Orpheum Children's Theater, which would facilitate more family and kid-oriented activities. That's coming. I think that's coming. I think that's inevitable.
But it's a big difference. What would people have seen in 1985 down here?
They would have seen emptiness. They would not have seen many people on the street. They would have heard echoes when they spoke. They would not have seen much traffic. And they would have seen some vacant storefronts.
You know, during the years when I was covering the council on a regular basis, one of the difficult issues that came across was police relations with the African-American community, which really came to a head with the shooting death by policemen of Kawan Carrington. How has that entire thread looked from your council seat?
It's been the greatest challenge the council's faced in the last 32 years because for many, many people, and particularly people in the African-American community, the face of the city is the police department. And so, what we've done in the wake of Kawan Carrington's death is try to look at use of force, try to look at ways to change, modify that, oversee it. We've experimented with a number of models of citizens review. A number of people have been designated to review that and are coming up with a way to try to incorporate that, as has been discussed for a number of years, into the functions of the Human Relations Commission in the city. This department has grown to the extent that problems and the awareness of those problems, a lot of them having to do with the police department, has evolved over the years. We now have a new position overseeing the continued build-out of an experimental approach to community input we had after Kewan Carrington's death. And it's being presided over by Tracy Parsons. And it involves two or three different programs. A community-wide summit was held. And out of that grew a body of people and a structure within which they could work that we call the Community Coalition. Buttressing the work that they do, we've now adopted an intervention program having to do with young people who are part of the gun violence situation, who feel trapped by it, to conduct interventions in the Fresh Start program and persuade them that they have some options they can exercise. Some people have been saved by that. Nothing is 100% effective, which is why we have to keep trying new approaches and keep adding to the approaches that we have underway. And I'm confident that that will occur.
When you look back to the Kewan Carrington shooting and before, do you see substantial change or progress?
I don't know how substantial. Very real, certainly. We had a culture in the police department that was not very productive. That is largely gone, due in great part to how careful we were in selecting a police chief. All the council people broke out in teams of two to interview candidates for the police chief. And I remember I grilled Anthony Cobb pretty hard.
And that's the current chief.
That's our current chief. And one of the things I pressed him hard on was, how willing are you to experiment with Citizens Review in Champaign? You've had experience with it in Urbana. And he was amenable to that. I strenuously urged that we hire him, and I think everybody is glad that we did. I think Cobb has been a real positive change in the police department, and I think he's presiding over a department in positive transition right now.
This was your district for 32 years.
Yeah.
What happened in this election, do you think?
I think a lot of people who assumed I would win didn't bother to vote. You know, I mean, the tears and shock I experienced from those who took this as a tremendous surprise suggest that. That's been spoken of to me. And I was busy doing the job while my opponent was busy cultivating contacts. The biggest issue in the most residential part of District 2 is what's going to happen when some of the older single-family houses or subdivided houses get torn down and they're going to be replaced. The redevelopment of commercial housing, apartments, is going to be major. The aesthetic impact on Precinct 13 is going to be huge. That was an issue that was brought to me by people. I kept hearing about it. Finally, I got it placed on the agenda for City Council and administrative consideration to have a public debate about this. Unfortunately, having succeeded in doing that, that public debate is going to take place without me. I was very, very caught up in governing, which is different from being caught up in politics.
Is it something that you want to return to? Do you see yourself running for the district seat again, or perhaps running for an at-large seat in a couple of years?
It's pretty premature to say. Obviously, somebody who's been involved in this a great deal and cared about it deeply and invested a great deal of themselves and their life in this kind of activity, it's always going to be a part of your bloodstream. And it's always going to be the sort of thing that gets your attention when you see changes that might escape the attention of people without that experience. So it's hard to say. There are a lot of things that I deferred for many years about which I've been pressured by people that I didn't have an opportunity to look at and do that I'm gearing up to devote time to. So, you know.
Before we started talking, you gave me a flyer for a poetry reading.
Yes.
You're doing, this is not new with you. You've been writing poetry for decades, right?
For decades, yeah.
Would it be possible for you to read something?
Oh, heavens. Yeah, I suppose so, yeah. Of course I could. Mm-hmm. Well, I got some stuff here. I always drag these things around. People who do this are always equipped with poetry. You carry it around like a good pocket knife and a box of dental floss. It's one of those things you think you might need at some point during the day. So let's see. Ah, I do have this with me. This has to do with Abraham Lincoln. And Lincoln's University was the state legislature. Lincoln's University, Lincoln's education was a political education. And he caught it in fits and starts as he was working at it. And he was a relatively young man. In the 1830s, our state capital was in Vandalia. And in the 1830s, the most powerful people in America were slave owners, cotton producers. Illinois was a free state, which suited Lincoln's inclinations well, just as that had suited his father's inclinations well, which is why the Lincoln family moved to Illinois. They wanted to get away from slavery. So when he was a legislator, a resolution was brought before the state legislature of Illinois, same legislation that was brought before state legislatures all over the United States, driven by the power brokers of the slaveocracy. They wanted a mandate. They wanted state legislatures to sign off on the concept of the perpetuation of slavery. It came to Illinois and was voted upon in March 1837. And Lincoln, who was relatively unknown, was one of a handful of people, small, slim minority, who spoke out against this and voted no and wanted it read into the record. And Lincoln observed that, you know what? The argument the slavers were trying to make was that the District of Columbia and its electors would be a proving ground, a laboratory for the question of what the American people would have to say about the perpetuation of slavery. And Lincoln opined before the legislature that the electors in Washington had the power as American citizens to vote on whether or not the institution should be abolished there. And it was thought then that however this went in the District of Columbia, it would go nationally. The supporters of slavery urged that this not happen and that it not be legally supportable. Lincoln jumped out in the issue and said, yes, by God, it's permissible and it ought to happen. And this is called a beginning at the end of the road because Vandalia was the end of the National Highway whose beginning was in Cumberland, Maryland. A road suggested by Washington, commenced by Jefferson, and built up between that time and Lincoln's time. So there you are in Vandalia, the end of the National Highway, and the railroad is on one side of the state capital, and the National Highway is on the other. The railroad points east, the National Highway pointed west. And when Lincoln evolved from the 30s to 1860, he became the man of the new technology, the new worldview, the railroad, and it was east on that railroad that he left Illinois forever as a living man to go to Washington and wrestle with these issues that bothered him in the 1830s. So this is called a beginning at the end of the road. Old slate lichen-stained stones face up from the east-west rail cut, absorb echoes and shadows from the State House in Vandalia, Illinois, western terminus of the National Highway, Cumberland Road. In the springtime of life, March 3, 1837, A. Lincoln held unquiet thoughts of what republic is, of whether bondage and republic could be reconciled, paralleling Main Street in Vandalia, paralleling Main Street all across America within a quarter of a century. The doubts of one man entered first in record here that bondage could be broken by the common will as it aligned parallel with common good on Main Street here, then everywhere that calls itself American. The registration of first doubt, then hope, writ here in Vandalia, Illinois. The parallelograms, square lines. The cupola suggesting vistas yet unseen, anticipated, simplicity, severity. All we think we hold esteemed of ancient Greece are deeply felt and simply stated here. then doubt, articulated by A. Lincoln, youngest, tallest of the long nine, daring to suggest that ancient models symbolized in architecture here were ill-served, that republic properly defined made of this place a temple, secular and no less sacred for it, a place where faith could only be sustained in doubt, that contemplated in extremis purifies. Old stones hold these echoes still, that we might doubt, becoming worthy to affirm.
Mike Ledoux, thank you very much.
My pleasure. You've indulged me.